Dr. Paul Woodruff is the Darrell K. Royal Professor of Ethics and American Society at the University of Texas at Austin. His specialty is ancient philosophy and the history of ideas in the ancient world. He is a graduate of Princeton University and Oxford, as well as a veteran of the war in Vietnam. He began teaching at the University of Texas in 1973. In 1988, he became chair of the Department of Philosophy, and in 1991 was named director of the Plan 2 Honors Program, a selective four-year undergraduate degree based on their core curriculum. He has won the Harry Ransom Teaching Award and is a member of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers at the University of Texas. Dr. Woodruff's scholarly publications include translations from many of the great authors of the classical period. He has a special interest in the climate of ideas that produced democracy in the ancient world. His book on that subject, First Democracy, The Challenge of an Ancient Idea, was recently released. His book, Reverence, Renewing a Forgotten Virtue, was published in 2001 by Oxford University Press and was recognized as being among the most notable of nonfiction for the year by the Christian Science Monitor. Dr. Woodruff and his family live in Austin, Texas. Let's give Dr. Woodruff a warm welcome to Brigham Young University. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, President Samuelson. I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you, Dan Graham. As you may discover, if you don't already know this, one of the joys of being a teacher is seeing your students outstrip you in scholarship. I am really delighted to be here in the vicinity of these mighty and awe-inspiring mountains, which I have not seen. Though I actually know they're there. At lunchtime yesterday, there was a dim outline and a little sunlight caught the snow-covered cap of one of the mountains, and as I was coming in here, I saw a little bit more of another one. But they are nevertheless awe-inspiring, and what is hidden is often the most awe-inspiring. You can apply that in many ways. You can think of the murk that is hiding these mountains as representing the human ignorance that hides many things from us. And you can think of the mountains as standing for, well, I don't think I'll tell you what to think of the mountains as standing for. They didn't invite me here to talk theology. I'll leave that part up to you. I'm here to talk about reverence. I do think, even though I can't see these mountains, that you're very lucky to be in this scenery because it means that you have an opportunity, constant opportunity to feel awe in the presence of what is mighty, mysterious, and beyond our control. And I'm reminded how beyond our control the forces of nature are when I hear stories about recent avalanches in these mountains, which are dreadful reminders of human limitations. Now, I read in the mission statement of this university, Brigham Young University has no justification for its existence unless it builds character. And, of course, there's quite a bit more to the mission than that, but that's the part I want to talk about. BYU has no justification for its existence unless it builds character. Well, what is character? It's a question that's interested me for a long time, ever since I served in the military in a war zone and noticed that some people behave there a lot better than others. And I began to ask why that was and what made the difference. Character, I think, is a reliable habit of doing the right thing. Not because you force yourself to do the right thing, not because you've spent a lot of time thinking and pondering in a rational, philosophical way, but because your emotions lead you to do the right thing. You feel like doing right if you have a good character. You actually enjoy doing the right thing if you have a good character. Because character is not forced. It's not compelled. Its roots are deep in your emotional life. An essential part of character is reverence. And that is my subject. And reverence is not forced. I think it's acquired and cultivated by cultivating habits of the heart, like, you know, experiencing awe at what is awe-inspiring and majestic and mysterious and partly hidden. Now, I have to confess, I feel a bit odd about presenting reverence here in this community, which, from what I've seen of it yesterday and today, seems to have done an uncommonly effective job in keeping reverence alive, better than most communities in America. I asked one of my friends who teaches here what were the lapses of reverence on campus that I should know about, and all he could think of was the rather rude use of a cell phone. Student asked him a question and answered and took a cell phone call while the professor was answering. And I thought, look, if that's the worst thing that's going on here, you really don't need me. But cell phones are a nuisance. I agree. And mine is turned off. If you have reverence, awe springs up in you at the moments when you are in the presence of what is awe-inspiring. If you are paying attention, it's very important that character traits like reverence only come into play when you're actually paying attention. And now I'll just indulge. This is the only time I'm going to do it in a comment for the Greek scholars in the audience. The Greek word for what I mean by paying attention is phronesis. Now, just forget that if you don't know Greek. That's just for them. Reverence, when you're mindful and paying attention, saves you from being too much in awe of yourself, because reverence is the habit of being in awe at what is indeed awe-inspiring. And let's face it, you are not, nor am I. We are, after all, only human, and we make mistakes. We are not all that mysterious. And we are not proper objects of reverence ourselves. The opposite of reverence is arrogance. And here I'm going to use another Greek word, but this one I'd like you to know if you don't already. The opposite of reverence, arrogance, overweening pride, was called by the ancient Greeks hubris, H-U-B-R-I-S. And they believed that hubris was due to forgetting that you are, after all, only human. Well, how can anyone forget, any human being forget, that he is human? And I don't apologize for the male pronoun. I'm afraid it usually is a he who forgets. It is easy enough to forget that you're human if you are wonderfully successful, wonderfully powerful, wonderfully rich, perhaps. If no one can stop you from doing what you want, or if you think that no one will ever catch up with you and punish you for doing what you want, if you think you can really get away with anything, then perhaps you are forgetting that you are human. This was the main theme of ancient Greek tragic poets, the ancient Greek tragic plays like Oedipus Tyrannus or Antigone or the Bacchae. The hubris of mighty men. And the cycle, the dreadful cycle that leads from success to arrogance, from arrogance to blindness, from blindness to error and from error to catastrophe that affects not only the leader who has hubris, but his people as well. That is the theme of Greek tragedy, that cycle from success to catastrophe by way of hubris. And what I only came to, I knew this, of course, from quite an early age, from reading the Greek tragedy. What I didn't realize until I started translating these poems is that many of the Greek tragedies include heartfelt hymns to reverence. And translating these plays and translating those hymns to reverence changed my life, because it made me realize that the theme of these plays, and an important theme in our own lives, is not just the negative theme of avoiding hubris, but the positive theme of cultivating reverence. And it did change my life to think about that. Now, on the subject of reverence in the ancient world, I was taught wrong by well-meaning teachers who had contempt for ancient religion, and I can see why. There are reasons for that. What they taught me was that the essence of the ancient idea of reverence was sacrificing the appropriate number of roosters or sheep or goats, or if you're very rich, cattle, in order to prevent earthquakes, plagues, and to ensure that good weather will be given you by the gods. On this kind of teaching, reverence in the ancient world consisted largely of a kind of magic, which was designed to manipulate the gods. The idea being that if you made the right moves, you would have the gods over a barrel and you could do what you want and get away with it. Now, indeed, some people had that idea in the ancient world, but it is not a reverent idea. And I think the ancient wise people understood very well that reverence tells you that the divine is not to be manipulated. God is not something that, or someone who can be manipulated by any means. We don't have control over that. It's not what it is to be human. I think it's universal in all the great religions to understand that the divine is not to be manipulated. And in all great religions, and even in very what we would think of as very primitive traditional religions, there is to be found a practice and a concept of reverence. Now, what do I mean by reverence? Reverence is not a practice like killing roosters. It is an ethical virtue that is most important and most valuable in human life when people have great power over others. Reverence is the felt remembrance that, strong as you are, you do not have divine powers. Reverence is remembering not to carry on as if you were a deity of some kind. Reverence is this memory of being human with all that means, that is fostered by a well-developed capacity for awe at what is awe-inspiring, because I think it is feelings of awe that remind us of our humanity. So keep looking at those mountains when you can see them. You may be successful enough, I hope many of you are successful enough, that you need reverence, that you need to remember that there are things much bigger than you are. But reverence is not only about awe and mountains and other beings that we cannot control, that are majestic and to some extent mysterious. At the human level, reverence is the basis for respect. And the language of reverence is ceremonial. Its effect on us, I think, is restraint in the use of power. And I will claim that reverence is the foundation of family and of the larger community that models itself on family. So these will be my themes: respect, restraint, ceremony, family. There's a lot more to say about reverence and a lot more to say about each of these themes than I will have time to say today, luckily for all of you. But there will be an opportunity to say more in the question and answer period. I want to introduce to you an ancient myth modified by a wise man of antiquity about the importance of reverence in community. And I'll build on that. The myth you may have heard, it's basically the story of Prometheus, but modified slightly. Prometheus' name means forethought. Prometheus, forethought. Now, according to this story, Prometheus had a little brother named Epimetheus, which means afterthought. And Epimetheus wasn't very bright. He was, however, given by the gods the task of distributing to the different animals as they were born out of the earth the means of survival. And so you have to imagine Epimetheus with a large Santa Claus-like bag of tricks, handing out something to each animal as it burrows its way out of the muck for the first time. And to rabbits, he gave speed and procreativity. You know, he gave shells to turtles, fangs and poison to snakes, claws and big teeth to lions. And to one animal after another, he gave out the means of survival. But when it came to the human beings, who were the last to emerge out of the mud on this story, there was nothing left in his bag of tricks. And so our ancestors were naked, unshod. They didn't have hoofs. They didn't have fangs. They weren't very fast. They weren't very procreative. It looked as if they would die out. But luckily, Prometheus, being quite a bit smarter than his brother, came on the scene, and he gave us what we needed to survive. He stole from heaven fire and technology. And as you know, if you've studied anthropology or the differences between us and animals, other animals, you know that's precisely right. You know, it is because we have fire and technology that we are able to be the most powerful animal on the planet. But according to this story, even that Promethean gift of fire and technology was not sufficient, because human beings did not know how to form stable communities. And they kept dividing, they kept fighting, they kept destroying each other and weakening each other so that wild beasts could make an end of them. And again, on this story, Zeus, looking down at the chaos in the human scene, wanting to save this species, gave them one more gift. And this gift was a double-barreled gift: justice and reverence. To be the foundation of community so that human beings would not perish from the earth. Well, the first time I read this story, I didn't get it. I thought it was kind of neat, but I didn't get it. Yes, I understood why justice was important to society. We need things to be fair and bad people to be punished and good people to be rewarded. But reverence seemed like a really old-fashioned idea, and I still thought it was all about roosters and goats. And I couldn't see what in the world that had to do with the survival of the human species. But I've been thinking about it over the years, and I realized that justice is not enough. Justice is not enough to provide us with the stable communities that we need in order to survive, because in addition to justice, we need at least respect. and reverence. Justice by itself can be harsh, unfeeling, divisive. The losers in a court of law, even though they deserve to lose, may be alienated and angry and bitter. There is a reason why courts of law are hedged around with reverent ceremony. And the reason is that reverence pulls us together, and we need to be pulled together around acts of justice, and justice alone is not enough to do that. Justice by itself can divide us, but reverence pulls us together. How is reverence expressed, and how is reverence shared? In what way does it pull us together? Well, we had an example just a few minutes ago. I think one of the languages of reverence is music. Music, because music expresses feelings, and reverence is often a matter of inarticulate feeling that can't be expressed in the way philosophers express things verbally. But music can express reverence, and you just did 20 minutes ago very nicely. And I have heard, in fact, just a few days ago, I heard a wonderful concert in which 1,000 people held their breath for a delicate pianissimo passage from Mozart, played by a great pianist, Peter Serkin. And there was a shared reverence in that moment. You might ask, reverence for what? The people in that concert hall were all of different faiths, some of no faith whatever. And I don't know quite how to explain many things about reverence, but this is one that I don't know how to explain. But I do think it is plainly true that we are able to share reverence in moments like this, when the clouds part and there is a momentary vision of some transcendent beauty, without having an articulate agreement about what we are reverent for, without sharing a theology, without agreeing on a precise account of God or our mission according to God, we are able to share reverence. And I think that offers great hope for humankind. Beliefs we may not be able to share around the world, but I think that reverence we may. Now, you may also experience reverence in the classroom. I'm going to talk about that quite a bit more later on this afternoon. But there is such a thing as a reverent classroom, and it's where you want to be. It's where learning is most likely to take place. In a reverent classroom, no one interrupts. No one needs to interrupt. And I mean neither the students nor the teacher are interrupting. In a reverent classroom, the teacher listens to the students. In a reverent classroom, there is a ceremonial observance of respect. People raise their hands before they speak. They speak in turns. They address what other people have said because they're listening to what other people have said. Now, you may suppose that the ceremony of raising your hands and waiting to be called upon before you speak is an empty ritual. In America these days, we tend to associate the words empty with ceremony and useless with ritual. But surely the ceremonies of a reverent classroom are not empty, and they're not useless. There is a kind of reverence in the classroom, and it seems to me that that is reverence for what is to be learned, for the truth that is awe-inspiring, somewhat mysterious because no one in the room knows all of it, and not under anyone's control. Respect and reverence are different in my understanding. You may use the words, you don't have to use the words the way I use them, but I think you should make the distinction I'm making, and these words help me make it. Reverence, I think, is for God or for anything transcendent. Respect is for each other. And the way I understand it, it's a mistake to be reverent towards a human being. Human beings are not godlike. And God deserves more than respect. Respect is what we should have for each other. Reverence is what we should have for God. And I think that respect is shared reverence. In order to be part of a circle of respect, you need to share reverence around that circle, and you need to find something that the people in that circle can revere together. Respect, this is really important, I think. Respect is not the same as recognizing the power of the teacher. It doesn't grow out of fear of the teacher. And I know this because I have visited a reverent classroom in which a teacher had sort of established reverent ceremonial behavior among the students. But I visited this classroom when the teacher wasn't there, and the same reverent behavior continued, not because I was there, not because he was there, because he wasn't, but because they had built it into themselves. It was built into the structure of their way of being students. Reverence is not forced. Like awe, it is a matter of feelings, and it cannot be faked. It cannot be artificial. So now I've said a little bit about respect and the difference between respect and reverence, and I'll say more in the question and answer period. But I want to turn now, because I've been asked to do so, to the issue of family. I think that what makes a difference between a family and a group of people who are gathered for convenience, and what makes a difference between a shelter where people sleep and eat and a home, is reverence. Now, I know that there are sort of special reasons in your faith for respecting the family. All cultures, of course, need to keep the family circle healthy, because the family circle is foundational for a healthy society. And even outside the family, you need to exercise some of the virtues of family life. I'm sure that you who are students away from home develop something like, you replicate something like a family circle among your friends and roommates, because you need that. It's part of being human. Family, however, is subject to change. And I've found through my own experience that there's a certain fallacy in establishing a family by having children. The trouble with children, there may be many other troubles with children, but this trouble is that they grow up, they go to college, they meet someone, they fall in love, they get married, they start their own families, and then it never quite feels the same afterwards. Though I know that having children can pull a couple together, but I've seen it also pull a couple apart. And I've seen families disintegrate after the children have left for college. You've probably seen it too. And I'll tell you a story from my own life here. After our children went away to college, we began to discard what had been a very important ritual with us, the family dinner, which we'd had as often as we could. Without the children, why were we doing it? With just two people, didn't feel like a family dinner. And then one night, my wife had a brilliant idea to light a candle at the dinner table, even though it was summer and the sun was out. And somehow that changed things, because the candle can only be lit for a short time. It pulls you in. You have to sit together in a circle to be in the light of a candle, to share its light. And gradually we recovered a sense of the importance of the family dinner, even though the family had changed. Then the children were no longer there. I told this story to a group that included a woman from Nigeria, quite a bit younger than I am, who grew up in a country village where, she told me, after dinner, the people of the village sat around a fire while the elders, the grandparents, told stories about the family and the history of the village. And so people knew their genealogies and knew the family's stories. And you can think of those fires as big candles. Well, last year she went back to her rural village in Nigeria, and the fires had gone out in every village, in every hut. There was a TV with a satellite antenna, and now people were isolated. There were no more stories, and there was no more role for the elders in telling the stories that kept the people together. Think how much isolates us now from one another. A few weeks ago, I bought an iPod, and one of my students saw it, and knowing very well that an iPod is a tool of isolation, said, "Oh, Dr. Woodruff, you have an iPod. Your poor wife." Well, I told her, I took the story home, and I told her about it, and she said, "Well, he doesn't know the half of it. He can't imagine what it's like being married to a philosopher. A philosopher always has an iPod running in his head with philosophical dialogue going on in it." So all the more reason to light the candle. So, you know, I put this question to you: what can you do? It's no doubt going to be different for different people in different families, but what can you do to bring a family into a circle that is made up of willing participants? You know, some of my friends here told me that on the family home nights that they know about, sometimes the circle isn't really a circle, and the kids fight, and people are off doing their own things, and so on. So I ask, what can you light or ignite in reality or metaphor that can bring people into a willing circle? The ancient Chinese knew the importance of the family circle, and they hedged it around with many ceremonies, as you may know. A small child, as soon as he or she is able to walk and talk, is taught in a Confucian family to greet the elder members of the family, each one with its own special token of respect. And this same child, if he grows up to be an emperor, will remember this habit of respect and treat those he rules with respect. That, I think, is the goal. And if you have come to know a Confucian family, you realize that they are wonderfully harmonious. When I give advice to a Chinese student who belongs to a Confucian family, I find I am wasting my breath unless I address family concerns, because that student will not think of himself as an individual, but as part of a family that makes decisions together. And as goes the family, so goes the world. In the Confucian idea, so even heaven and earth are related in harmony as a family is. And that is the goal. Now, Confucian China began to unravel when people began to fear that ceremony was empty and meaningless. There's a huge cost to letting your rituals and your ceremonies become empty. Reverence is what keeps your ceremonies from being empty. And I actually think that's the main message of the Confucian Analects. Don't let your ceremonies become empty. Fill them with the appropriate feeling, which is reverence. The ancient wise people were right. Reverence is essential to human life, and we need it now more than ever, because isolation is so easy now. And when we are isolated, abuse so easily follows. Think of the people who are most vulnerable to abuse, small children, the elderly, prisoners. Reverence in traditional society shelters the stranger at the door, promises safety for the doddering grandmother in the rocking chair by the fire, protects the small child alone with a teacher or a priest, stands between the prisoner and his guard when no one is watching and the digital cameras are banned. We have preserved some reverence in our society. We need to build on that. And you, especially in this community, have preserved reverence, and you have a foundation to build upon that you are very fortunate to have, and I hope you find ways of doing that. I'll end with three pieces of advice for maintaining and renewing reverence in your lives. Speak the language of reverence with feeling. That's my first piece of advice. The language of reverence includes music, ceremony. Speak it with feeling. The second piece of advice, kindle the lights that bring people into circles of shared reverence. You must find what those lights are. And most important, pay attention. Be silent when silence is called for. Be mindful of what is awe-inspiring. And be mindful of each other. Be mindful of everything around you, from your roommate's concerns to the song of the birds and to these majestic mountains, which I still have not seen. Thank you very much.